welcome to the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast. I am Don Bishop, and I write as T.S. Pedramon. And here I am today with author C.R. Rowenson.
Hi.
And what do I call you? Do I call you C.R.?
Clark. Just Clark.
Clark.
I'm okay. Actually working on shifting from C.R. Rowenson to Clark Rowenson because the whole C.R. thing was apparently has been very confusing in a lot of situations. So I'm like,
yeah,
maybe that's too much.
Yeah, I have some insecurities about my pen name, but I wanted some amount of separation. And, you know, I don't keep my first name secret. Like, if you go to whatever you find about me, you'll be able to find this podcast and I introduce myself with my real name. But
yeah. Yeah. And I originally went with a pen name because at the time I was doing, when I started getting serious about my writing, I was doing a job that involved research and some sensitive areas, and I didn't want people to end up associating like my professional papers with my fiction stuff. I didn't want people to do a search for one name and find both things. That's not really an issue anymore because that's not what I do anymore, but that was part of the original idea behind it anyway.
Well, let's let our listeners get to know you. So do you mind telling us a bit about yourself, like your education or your pre-writing career?
Sure. Yeah. So I have two bachelor's degrees, one in chemistry and one in chemical engineering. And while I was getting my degrees, that's actually when I started writing, which is a longer story, but I came up with a very complicated magic system. I was telling my friends about it. They got tired of me talking about it. So I thought I would trick them into wanting to hear about it by writing it into stories. And, you know, 11 years later, here we are. But yeah, chemical engineering and chemistry, which has been very formative in like how I think and how I approach things. Spent several years doing research. I used to do research into 3D printing and like energetic materials. Don't do that anymore. Now I do project management and I'm working on trying to shift to full-time writing. Right now, everything I do is nonfiction about magic systems. So I do coaching and I write books and I have a YouTube channel where I generally just provide tools and content to help storytellers of all kinds craft and repair their magic systems. And I think
I actually have one of your books over here. I'm going to step off camera for a second.
Oh, nice.
So we grabbed this at the rave event at the end of 20 books in 2022. So this is the magic system blueprint.
Oh, so you grabbed that the year that I was sick in the hotel room.
Were you?
It was 2022, the 20 books staff were very nice and they had some people man the table for me because I was up in my hotel room. Like terribly, terribly sick.
Having not a great time. Yeah, and my wife and I came down with something as well.
Yeah. And then 2023, I like almost completely lost my voice. So anyway, those rave events have been hard for me.
Yeah.
But yeah, that's one of my books. And as we had talked about in some of our emails, because for me, magic system is a much broader net than a lot of people initially think. Because people generally think, you know, dragons, wizards, fantasy, and that's where they stop when it comes to magic systems. And I think it is a lot more than that. When I'm talking about magic systems, I'm using kind of a catch-all term for any of the fantastic elements in our stories. So anything that's beyond our capability or understanding, which definitely includes advanced technology, astrological phenomenon, interplanar phenomenon, literally anything that is that step beyond the actual reality of your readers.
That's really interesting to think about. Because, I mean, in your book, you talk about, and I think you mentioned also Brandon Sanderson's terminology where he says hard and soft magic systems.
Yeah.
And you prefer the term, the terminology of rational versus irrational.
So I do really like the hard and soft, but there was some explanations in the essay that didn't quite make sense to me. The biggest one is in the essay, he talks about things like Superman. And I always had a hard time putting Superman next to Mistborn. Because in his essay, he talked about how those are both hard systems because we know what they're capable of. So that's why I spent years thinking about it. Eventually, I found an article on Mythcreants where they talked about creating irrational magic. Creating rational magic. And that's where it kind of clicked. So I used that quadrant to get, so you have the hard, soft access and the rational, irrational access, which.
So yeah. For our listeners' benefit and also for my own benefit, because I haven't read this book cover to cover, but you use rational and irrational to say like Mistborn is very rational. You can, once you learn how the magic system works, you can predict that if you do X, then Y will happen. Mm-hmm. Whereas irrational would be Harry Potter, where the Expelliarmus spell works exactly as we observe it. And if we want to wonder if it would work in some other scenario, we can't predict that. So like, would it work with a book or a gun?
Correct.
We don't know. All we know is that it will expel a wand.
Correct.
From a magic user's hand.
Yeah.
Because it's an irrational system. It's not something that you can put the pieces together, predict something. Now, what would you, because I think I missed something. If hard and soft is a different axis, then how does that apply?
Yeah, so hard and soft, so in a nutshell, the two axes work like this. Hard and soft is what percent of the magic system is explained or understood. The more of the total system that is explained or understood, the harder a system it is. You can kind of think of it like looking at an image. The more of the image you can see clearly, the more in focus it is, the sharper and harder an image it is. And then rational, irrational, that's about rules, patterns, and logic. The more you can extrapolate from what you have seen to what you haven't seen, the more rational it is. The less you can extrapolate, the more irrational it is. Which, just like what you talked about with Expelliarmus, which was my example, we know it works that way. We can't apply the logic of how that spell works to anything else until we see it in the book. And the reason for that is because there's a lot of situations where if we could apply the logic to that, there then start to be a lot of plot holes and a lot of problems. So we kind of have to go with the assumption that either it won't do it, or there are reasons that they won't, but we don't know the rationale, we don't know the logic, and we kind of have to just roll with it. Superman and Superman is similar. We know what he can do, but the rationale between the things he can do isn't really connected. Especially when you get to some of his ancillary powers, like his eye beams and his frost breath and stuff like that. You're not going to go from being able to fly. Logically, it's hard to go from being able to fly to eye beams.
Yeah, well, and if you watch Man of Steel, which I actually did rewatch recently, his father uses the terminology that his cells will drink in the sun's light, and like if his cells are drinking in the sun's light and making them strong, like you could extrapolate strength, right? Physical strength, and maybe some kind of immortality from that. Like, how does that even get to flying?
Right.
Let alone laser eyes or frost breath.
And I wasn't super into Superman. And the first time somebody tried to explain to me that his flying is a feat of strength from him basically just jumping really well, I about lost my mind. I'm like, are you kidding me? That makes no. You should have just left it at flying. Like, come on.
I've heard another aspect of his life, or his living. Explained kind of on the opposite end of that spectrum, where it's not that he flies by jumping really well, it's that he walks around by suspending himself over the earth. Like, he is incredibly massive that he should be like sinking through into the ground, but he's actually always subconsciously flying as he walks around and lies down and whatnot.
Yeah, interesting. But yeah, not saying it is a bad system. It does what it's supposed to do for the story, whether you like it or not. But it's not a rational system. Because then if you expand it, even if his powers made sense, what we know about Superman does not apply to the villains or to any of the other heroes in the DC universe, which is very similar to Marvel. Marvel does generally does better having some rationale behind each of the heroes, even if it's kind of superficial connection. But then between the heroes, it sort of falls apart, which is why I consider those to generally be like harder irrational systems. As we generally know what each individual hero and villain can do very well, but what you know about one does not teach you anything about any of the others.
Mm-hmm. Do you mind if I show a page in your book?
No, go for it.
Okay, so here's the chart for Mistborn. Hold on, because now I'm blocking my... Okay, there we go. And we can see you have quadrants here. There's hard versus soft, and there's rational versus irrational. And then you have some other categories there with sliders that people can get into if they read the book.
Yeah.
But with Mistborn, it's hard and rational, where the magic system is explained to us and it's consistent, where you can extrapolate to conclude that something will work a certain way.
Yeah.
As opposed to in The Lord of the Rings, it's soft and irrational. There was no way we could have known beforehand that Gandalf was going to come back to life.
Especially not
could talk to the moths to bring the eagles.
Especially not in the context of just the trilogy. In order to know and understand any of it, you have to start getting into the Silmarillion and other content.
So do you have a favorite quadrant that you like to work in? Or do you find yourself repeatedly coming back to?
My default tends to be hard rational. I try and push myself as I'm building systems to try and explore some of the other quadrants. Because they all have value, and they all lend themselves to different types of stories. But for you or any of your viewers who are familiar with Sanderson's First Law, the easiest way to think of it is his conversation about hard and soft kind of runs diagonally from the hard rational down to soft irrational. So if you're thinking of the way Sanderson's definition of soft, that's generally soft irrational. And his exemplar hard systems are generally hard rational. But yeah,
I could see that in tendencies, you know, so that the fact that you went and wrote this book would probably lead me to guess that you would lean towards hard and rational because
yes.
you're deliberately thinking about what's going on here.
Yes.
And that means you're probably developing a magic system that is going to lean towards being well-defined, mm-hmm. if I can use other words to say hard.
Yeah.
Being well-defined and to have some consistency that, where you could call it rational.
Yeah. And even in the systems that I have built, hard rational is definitely my default. When it's not hard rational, it's usually soft rational. Getting outside of the rational side is very tough for me.
So would you have any good examples of soft rational?
Yeah. So soft rational, those tend to be systems where there's logic and there's rationale, but the system itself is very large. Because then the chances of you understanding 100% of the system or even 60% of the system is very low. That is very common when you're dealing with sci-fi and the tech is your magic system. So Stargate is kind of my go-to example. All of the tech of the Goa'uld, of the Ancients, of the Asgards, and then if you get into Atlantis, of the Wraith, there's so much there, so many capabilities and different things that can be done with the technology. We don't know all of it. They don't pretend that they have shown us all of it. New things can show up at any time, but what has been shown does contain rationale that we can logically apply to other stuff, so that when new devices and things make up show up, it usually makes a kind of sense.
And I don't have any examples of this, but could a soft rational system be something that is very well defined to the author, but not fully exposed to the reader?
Yes. So especially when we're dealing with the blueprint, perspective is a huge, huge part of it. I half jokingly say that I spent like a year or more working hard to develop this blueprint and ended up adding the perspective box at the end, which is just a little box in the top right of the form. And it's actually the most powerful part of the entire freaking blueprint. But absolutely. And in fact, whenever I plan a story with any kind of irrational magic system, any kind of irrational magic system, I have to build it as a rational system to me. And then I deliberately obfuscate things. I plan what I'm going to be hiding and what isn't going to be explained so that it doesn't feel rational to the reader and to the characters. Hard rational to me, I can mask it up and present it as soft. I can present it as anything to the readers if I manage it right. It is hard to present a system as harder and more rational to the readers than it is to you as the author. So that's something to bear in mind. If you want it to be hard rational for them, it's going to need to be hard rational to you.
Yeah. Yeah. Or you're walking on thin ice.
You're probably going to make a mistake.
So you made me think of Thomas K. Carpenter. I had him on the podcast. His episode came out December 21st, but his 100 Worlds universe is a grouping, I guess, of multiple series, and each series has its own. I haven't read them, so
okay.
I think he said that each series has its own magic system.
Okay,
but they all exist within the same world, so it's kind of like maybe to bring it back to Sanderson, maybe in one series it's all about the Skybreakers, and another series is all about the Windrunners, and
right.
Perhaps I don't know, but it's kind of a learning environment also,
right?
I'll stop trying to represent his books because I don't understand them well. But
yeah, that sounds very similar to Sanderson's Cosmere, where like they are overall linked in some level that you don't necessarily understand right away.
Yeah, and I assuming that my huge gambit works in taking this foray into becoming a novelist, because my listeners will know, like, I don't have any published books yet, and I'm in a Kickstarter campaign right now for my first book. It's reached funding level. It's
nice.
It's 800% funded right now.
Nice.
And it closes at the end of the month, and it hits public launch February 28th, and then I hope it sells. And like I have a kind of a financial runway that's only so long, and I got to make it work.
Right.
And I have a couple of tricks in there, like our old house we haven't sold, and goose with a golden egg, right? We could kill that goose and sell that house, and that would extend our runway.
Right.
But so assuming that like that this gambit works, then I'll publish my Nightshade Unicorn series, which, by the way, is soft irrational.
Nothing wrong with that.
It's getting a little harder, hard irrational, as I go on, but I think it needs to live in the irrational space. Now, there's some rationalities to it.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I have stated that the male unicorns, and I call them unicorns Nemord, but the male Nemord have a couple of powers, and the female Nemord have a couple of powers. But there's some magic construct that was enacted several millennia ago that used both of them in concert. and I have not hashed out what they can do when they work together.
Okay.
So that's a huge irrational spot.
Okay.
So if assuming my huge gambit works and I am able to keep publishing, I'll work my way through the Nightshade Unicorn series, and then I'll turn my attention to the Grenhill Chronicles, which this podcast is named after, which is definitely going to be going to be hard rational. Mm-hmm. And actually, I'll anybody listening to this is going to be kind of in the secrets, I guess, because I'm not going to talk about this in the books, but in the Grenhill Chronicles, it's in my mind, it's built off of a sci-fi background.
Okay.
Like the Dragon Riders of Pern.
Mm-hmm.
Dragon's Dawn is a sci-fi book, but the rest of the Dragon Riders series is essentially fantasy.
Right.
So the Grenhill Chronicles is like that, where it has a sci-fi ancient history. And so I don't know how I could logically write soft or irrational if I want to keep this idea in my mind at the same time. It could be done, but that's not in my mind. Like I'm writing different stories in that universe already.
Mm-hmm.
Like I have a couple of short stories. One of them has only begun, but they exist in the same. So the Grenhill Chronicles has its own universe,
mm-hmm.
with multiple worlds. There's traveling between worlds. We don't use the word planet, right? But multiple planets. And on one planet, there is a huge forest of immense trees, you know, like picture the home tree from Avatar.
Right.
So there's one short story where the people live high up in the branches, and they have their kind of agriculture going on. And I recently wrote a short story that takes place down among the roots underground. And that's just a small segment of the Grenhill Chronicles universe.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm monologuing. I'm sorry.
Oh no, you're good. You're good.
I talk too much, but it's like that's hard rational, right? None of them are going to be, jumping up and suddenly flying. And they live in this huge tree, which is the product of genetic engineering,
right?
In their ancient past that they don't remember, right. They don't know,
right? And rational doesn't have to mean scientific or realistic. It just means that,
right?
When you as
Doctor Who,
yeah, it just means
is
that
very
once
irrational.
You've established a rule, everything follows that rule. That's really what it means, like. If it's rational, there are minimal exceptions, if any exceptions, to the rule. Because again, returning to Expelliarmus, if the descriptor for that spell, if we were talking about like an RPG, is it knocks an item out of your opponent's hand. If that's the description, that's the rule, then that means it's literally any item. Which means you might even be able to use it in creative ways, where if they're like hanging off of the edge of a skyscraper by one hand and you do Expelliarmus, they lose their grip. Like that's rational extrapolation from the rule that has been set. Because they're technically holding the skyscraper.
but I could see that the J.K. Rowling could easily say, no, that wouldn't work because the skyscraper isn't going to fly out of their hands.
Right.
Like, is... what does Expelliarmus do? Does it loosen your grip or does it make the thing fly?
Right.
And your average wizard is probably not powerful enough to make the skyscraper fly.
Right. Yeah. And that's where the rationale and the rules and the information applies. Because if we dug into it, and let's say that if we spun off on that and we took certain aspects of Harry Potter, which this is one thing that I actually really enjoyed doing, and you started me on this tangent. But so it's your fault, not mine.
We can do it.
You can take concepts and then you can build them into new systems. So what you're talking about with Dragon Riders of Pern or taking scientific concepts or the Numenera series and like setting in D&D or even the Swords of Shannara, where you're anything where you're doing like a post dying earth that has then morphed into a fantasy, you're taking aspects of something we know, giving it different representation and then adding new tweaks to it that turn it into a magic system. If we wanted to, we could take some of the stuff with Harry Potter and take some of like the charm effects and say, this is biological magic. This works by you manipulating the biology of your target. At which point, just by defining that, we know a lot more about how Expelliarmus works. It's not going to be telekinesis that knocks it out of their hand. It's literally you're forcing them to throw it and let go. And all of a sudden, that means you can make them drop off the side of the skyscraper. And that's taking that concept and extrapolating out. If this is true, what does that mean in all of these situations? And it doesn't have to be scientific. It just needs to follow its rules.
And I guess my Nightshade Unicorn series is I guess moderately soft, because I have declared a few things. And so like the male Namord, the male unicorns have the ability to influence minds. Oh goodness, I don't want to give away any spoilers for my first book, but there's if you were to like steal their power, would it work the same way for you? Maybe, maybe not.
Right.
But it would be along those lines, you know, like grafting a branch from a tree onto another tree.
Right.
You're going to change the way that fruit grows on that branch.
Right.
But it will retain some aspects of the original tree.
Right. Most definitely. And since you're talking about how the series is built on sci-fi, when we had been chatting, we had talked about maybe getting a bit more into how magic applies to sci-fi. Is that something you want to talk through a little more?
Yeah.
I guess, do you have any questions or do you just want me to go?
we could jump in. And I could see, because you mentioned something that's, I don't remember. I would see Doctor Who as being in an uncommon quadrant, because we have some things that are hard, like the TARDIS, its basic powers, what it can do in the story are pretty well set. But, and I haven't watched Doctor Who in the last couple of years, but they stopped having it on Netflix and I also lost interest, but they pull some things out of left field.
Yeah.
Not infrequently.
Right.
They'll just pull something out of a hat that you could not have seen that coming.
Right. And they pull out new creatures and new concepts. And while like specific spots are, I'm not even going to say well explained, more explained. They always leave it open to pull new things out of anywhere, which is, that's a classic example of a soft magic system. Is it so broad? They're like, we're not saying that you know everything that's out there, because you don't, because we're going to make stuff up as we go.
Yeah. There was an episode, that I would say you could argue is pretty, pretty rational sci-fi. I hesitate to use the term hard sci-fi because that implies that you've determined how things work, and it's a time travel show. So yeah, anyway. So there's the one episode, and I don't remember if it was Matt Smith or Peter Capaldi, where he was locked inside kind of a trinket. He couldn't see it, you know, he couldn't find his way out, but he was locked inside this mini universe, indeterminately. And the kind of the rules of the universe were set up pretty early on, and yet when you get to the end, there's a twist that you don't expect, and you watch him. And do you know what episode I'm talking about? He's
sure
locked inside a castle, and there's this hooded creature following him, but it walks slowly, and he's running around trying to find a way out of this castle and and he knows that he's been locked in there. And he is teleported in there.
Mm-hmm.
And when he arrives, he kind of looks at the apparatus that brought him there, makes some analysis of it really quick, and then goes about trying to find a way out. And he winds up, he's in this thing for 4 billion years or 2 billion years.
Huh.
But he's locked inside this thing for a long time. And the rules of this little universe don't change throughout the episode. It's actually pretty consistent. And he finally uses the devices put in place at the beginning of the episode to escape. And then you have other episodes where there's David Tennant in Shakespearean England, and there are these aliens using words to have real world effects, and his companion is like, is gonna tell people something about tell the common people, like, yeah, you know, we'll help you against this witchcraft.
And like, he's like, you can't tell them that witchcraft.
She's like, okay, what is it?
He's like, it's witchcraft.
So like, it's nominally a sci-fi show, mm-hmm. but there's straight up witchcraft in it.
Yeah.
But then at the end of the episode, they use kind of a coding, you know, they use the words, they throw in a bunch of numbers there as if it's some universal code,
mm-hmm.
Which kind of puts a sci-fi underlayment underneath the witchcraft.
Yeah.
But then there's an episode with the devil, and he has the devil planet, and it's pulling them in.
Right.
And okay, sorry. So you were going to talk about how magic systems apply to sci-fi. I'll let you talk.
So that's actually an excellent example, because there are some actual technical mechanical differences between like fantasy magic and technology. But for the most part, it's flavor and presentation, which is kind of what you're talking about here. Is those things just as easily could have worked in just a fantasy story where they're hopping around between worlds, and they just wouldn't bother to try and add that little bit of like, here's how it connects to the world, and it just connects in a way that we don't understand, and you don't need to, because it's Doctor Who. The Doctor understands. Moving on. But a lot of times it's a lot of flavor, which is part of why I catch everything in a broad net. And we've talked about fantasy and sci-fi. This also includes any like horror stuff, especially like Lovecraftian horror, creature features, all of that kind of thing. Presentation is a huge part of it. So when you're looking at your genre, it's going to change the final coat of paint and how you present things. But at the core, they're still all magic systems, and we can approach building them the same. Now, if you want, we can talk about the actual technical difference in my mind between magic and technology. Or we can dig more into like instances of magic and sci-fi. This is the problem of having me talk about magic. I can talk about anything for a long time. So.
Well, let's get into magic versus technology, and I'll insert the quote. I don't remember who it was. They say
Arthur
that sufficiently advanced technology is indistinguishable from magic.
Yes. And there's a webcomic called Girl Genius where in one of their little short adventures, somebody says sufficiently explained magic is indistinguishable from technology. So that's kind of the foundation of how I look at a lot of this stuff.
Midichlorians much?
They tried. I have a video on this on my YouTube channel where I talk about the difference between magic and tech more in depth. Because when we're talking about building it as a storyteller, they're the same. They're magic systems, and then it's flavor and it's presentation. Really, where it becomes important to me as magic versus technology is how it impacts the world and how people can interact with it in the world. And there, the main difference has to do with it's the transference of the means of production. Because the magic effects can come from innate abilities, special rituals, or magic items. And transference is one of the sliders in the blueprint. Technology in sci-fi stuff tends to have high transference because that's the point.
Yeah.
I want this device to do magical effects, and the point of having a device do it is so that I can hand it off to other people. That's one of the points of it. Because mass producing laser pistols wouldn't do much good if I was the only one who could use the laser pistols that I produced. I mean,
unless you just wanted to have a weapon ready anywhere you go.
Right. And unless you're a gadgeteer type character where you're only building your stuff for yourself, and that's where it bleeds into, like, is this technology or is it just kind of magic? Which is like what you see in D&D and Pathfinder with, like, the alchemists and the gadgeteers, where, like, they can do all of this stuff, but it's not always something they can just hand to somebody else. So at that point, it's just a more technical form of magic.
Fabrials.
Yes.
In Way of Kings. What's the series called? Stormlight Archives. Fabrials.
Yeah. So high transference is usually an important part of technology, but that itself doesn't guarantee it. Because the Fabrials are a great example. Sanderson has a lot of things that serve as great examples for this. But if you have something where people can temporarily gift powers, that's getting ahead of myself. So that's transference, right? Is the ability to hand off the capability of producing the effect. How easily can it be transferred from one person to another? And if it's a device, it's usually pretty easy. Like cell phones, doesn't matter who picks it up. You can hand it off to other people and the device works the same. Laser pistols, flamethrowers, cloaking devices, all of that kind of stuff. Now, where it really gets interesting is how the items are produced. Because you can have stories where magic, understanding of magic has developed to the point that people have figured out how to mass produce things with high transference. So you might have, Tad Williams has a book, War of the Flowers, where in the Fae, the fairies have a whole industrial society built up, and they have trains and they have devices and all kinds of stuff that they use. But the way that they do it is by draining the innate magic out of fairy folk. So the source of the magic is still the fairies. But they have taken the magic and they have mass produced it and they've applied it in a variety of ways, creating a technological aspect to the society. So there, because all of them have magic, the means to produce it is available to anybody, as long as they're a fairy. Main character is a human. He shows up. He doesn't have the same innate magic. He can't be used as a capacitor the same way, like, fairy folk can. So there, the means of production can be transferred to anybody. You just need to know the process and have the magic. And if you're a fairy, you have the magic, period. Now, Fabrials are a little different because there, all you need is the knowledge and the spren, which are these little magical essences that float around in their world for anybody who hasn't read the series.
And the Stormlight.
Yes, and the Stormlight.
Ending.
But you don't have to be a Knight Radiant or even a Soulcaster. You don't have to have any magical abilities to create and use Fabrials. So that's the main difference, is the transference of the means of production. If it's just knowledge, then it's true technology, because anybody can pick it up and then anybody can technically create it, provided they can get the means, the process, materials. But there's no magical restriction to them making it. Like in our world, explosives, nuclear weapons, computers, polymers, any of that kind of stuff. That knowledge exists now, and anybody could technically do it. There's nothing about, like, you have to have a specific gene in order to make plastic. And that's where.
Although,
Go ahead.
as kind of an interesting factor that once you have an instance of the technology, you can lock it down so that nobody else can use it.
Yes.
And not just with knowledge, right? Like not just stealing somebody's password, because now we have phones that you can lock with your fingerprint. And I don't want to go too deep into crypto. First off, I'm not a crypto expert, but in cryptography, you can, yeah, without going deep into the little bit that I do understand, you can put a key on a USB drive, and now you can only access your Bitcoin wallet or whatever thing it is with that USB drive,
But that.
or with your ID card that has a smart chip inside that has the key inside there.
But that is a security measure that they are adding to the system. The system
Yes.
itself is not inherently limited. So let's take the fab rails for a second and say adjust it so that it can't be produced by. Actually, let's shift over to something like D&D, where magic items have to be created by wizards because you need to have, granted, the wizards there are just studiers of the arcane, but you have to have studied enough to have like magical capability. And so only people with magical capability can produce enchanted items. Enchanted items are effectively pieces of technology, but the means of production is limited to people with specific abilities and attributes. And that changes the nature of how that technology can grow and affect things in the world. It's a small difference, but it's an important difference. So there, if a wizard just handed their manual of how to create an enchanted sword to somebody, it wouldn't work because they need to be able to manipulate the forces of magic in order to do it.
Yeah, and we can go back to Harry Potter with this. Like, a muggle can't brew a potion.
Correct.
Once the potion is brewed, maybe a muggle could take the potion and
Correct.
utilize those magical effects. But it takes magic. Maybe I'm wrong. Maybe there are some potions that a muggle could brew, but
We don't know. They never really talk
I think
about
there
it.
was some waving of the wand over the cauldron for some potions, in which case it would have to be a wizard who could do it.
And that's some of the stuff where, like, the Harry, going back to what we were talking about before, it gets into some of the irrational side. Is there's just information we don't know, so we can't assume it's true. Because by that, I don't know. Brooms might just be technology that a muggle, if they got their hands on them, could use. Or maybe it's magical technology that requires that hint of magic in you to actually activate. We don't know. That never really gets explored.
How do you I'm gonna go out on a limb here, and I'm gonna tell a joke that I just thought of. So how do you get a broom out of Hogwarts or whatever, and into the arms of your non-magical friend? How do you get it through so that they can use it?
I don't know.
You smuggle it.
I like
Okay, that was bad.
it. That's a good dad
But yeah,
joke.
my understanding is that flying on a broom, even though the broom has its own magic in it, my understanding is in Harry Potter, non-magical folk can't fly on a broom. You need magic in your being to be able to say up and have the broom jump up to your hand.
And So, and that's a piece of like the technology versus versus magic and the transference and stuff. And it's something I really like to nerd out about. And in my definition, it's really, really getting into that fine detail because at that level of determining who it is that can produce the items that are functioning as technology has implications on how things can grow and how things can be controlled. So like
Sorry, go on.
I mean, I was my brain was kind of trailing off on me, so that was
Do you have any hot takes or unique view at magic that is not replicable or transferable, where it's kind of a singular thing, where the Ender's Game series, and I've got to say, we got some nice snow last night, and there are my kids playing out in the snow. You can see out the window.
Nice.
I think this is the first time I've my kids have been visible in the backyard during an interview. But take the Ender's Game series. Later in the series, the inherent in-universe magic of the Ansible is revealed to kind of cross outside of the universe.
Mm-hmm.
And the Formicans have kind of a closer access to this outside than humans do. And then there's the AI. I don't remember her name.
I don't either. It's been a long time since I only made it through Speaker for the Dead. It's been a long time.
But she's Ender's friend, and she lives in the computers between the Ansibles.
Mm-hmm. She was basically born of the space between the Ansibles.
Yeah. Yeah. And she is unique. So how would you chart her anywhere on your four quadrants?
So you could, and this is where all of this, the blueprints and the way I talk about stuff is I'm always trying to provide a frame of understanding so that people can do their own analysis and their own application and their own development. None of what I'm saying is gospel, and I never try and pretend that it is. So with Ender's Game, you could take each of those fantastical elements and look at them in isolation and consider them as separate systems. Or you could try and consider all of them at once and map out the totality of the magic in the series. And mm-hmm. how you want to do that depends on what makes sense to you. Because we talked about Marvel before. If you wanted, you could look at each hero and each villain as a individual magic system and map it out there. And if you did that, then it's just dozens and dozens of hard, more rational than irrational magic systems. But to me, at that point with Marvel, you sort of hit a tipping point where there's so many of these tiny systems, it's easier to just consider them all as one big one, which is what definitively drives it over to the irrational side for me.
Because there's Spider-Man and there's Ant-Man,
right?
Which, despite being named after, what's the word? Arthropods.
Yeah.
Are based on very different principles.
Yeah.
Where there's no genetics involved in the creation of Ant-Man's suit.
Right. Right.
And then there's no like quantum anything involved in Spider-Man's web slinging.
Mm-hmm.
And there's Captain America, and that's also biochemical like Spider-Man.
Right. But
different.
Very different, yeah. So it depends on how you want to look at things. So with Speaker for the Dead, the AI could be her own separate magic system. And that is the reason I'm getting through all of that, because people will often ask, like, can you have multiple magic systems in a story? Absolutely. Which, by the way, magic systems don't have to be complicated. They can be exceedingly simple. Mm-hmm. A magic system is just the patterns, rules, and information that makes the magic understandable. That's it. So with that in mind, you can have multiple complicated systems, which is what Sanderson does in Mistborn and Sanderson does in Stormlight Archives. Or actually, Stormlight Archives is a single, much, much bigger magic system. Or you can have a variety of small ones that are all kind of interacting in weird ways, which Star Wars, I break down into two magic systems, because you have the Force and the Jedi powers, and then you have the general technology. And those are mm-hmm. different magic systems. You can have most of the world operate with one magic system and add an anomaly as its own magic system. You can do that. There's nothing wrong with that. So the AI might truly be her own magic system where everything else follows under a singular magic system. And then she's just this tiny little isolated, fairly simple magic system of her own. You can do that. Like, it's,
yeah,
you can break this stuff down and tease it out any way you want. I just find having that frame and thinking of it in these ways makes it easier to play with and use effectively.
Okay.
So I hope that answered your question.
I think we have some visitors in the background. Oh, the camera doesn't see my younger daughter's face.
No, just the waving sun.
Agachate. Agachate. Agachate.
There we go. Although the picture would be much clearer if we could see into the top pane of glass.
Looks like they're having a good time though.
Yeah. Yeah, they are. Yeah, I guess we should probably wrap it up, but thanks for coming on and talking about this. It was a really, really interesting discussion.
Not a problem. Always enjoy.
Where can listeners find you on the web?
Yep. The best place to find me is on YouTube. The channel is The Magic Engineer. And the best way to contact me is my website, which is crrowanson.com. I have a contact form. You can email me there. You're I'd love to talk to people in the comments, but if you want to have a chat just with me, you want to go to crrowanson.com, or if you want to talk with me about potentially getting coaching help. And my coaching is about more than just magic systems. So if you or anybody is, don't feel you need to be stuck on your magic system to talk with me. Generally, what I say is if you're stuck on any part of the writing process or something feels harder than it should be, let's talk about it.
Okay.
Those are the best places to find me.
I'll put links in the show notes.
Awesome.
Excuse me. In both the audio only podcast and on the YouTube video. So I'll put those links in the show notes.
Excellent.
And I guess that's that. This will be going out on the 25th. So just next Thursday.
Okay.
Excellent. Today we recorded this on January 16th. Anyway, yeah, that's that. Thank you for coming on. I appreciate it.
Yeah, thanks for having me. Happy. Let me know if you want to do one of these again sometime. Happy to come chat about stuff. If you want to dig into any of the stuff from your stories or your systems, I always enjoy doing that and kind of helping people break down what they've done into the frameworks that I use. I really enjoy that. So just let me know.
Yeah, will do.
All right.
Thanks.
Have a good one.
Okay, before you go, I want to thank everybody for watching or listening, as the case may be. And I wanted to give you some general updates. Now, if you saw my kids in the window there, I think that was really cute. I don't think I showed enough for you to get a good look at them. And the window was kind of dirty. So anyway, but yeah, we had a lot of snow here. That's a relative term for our part of the country. It was significant. For other parts of the country, it would be nothing. But they kind of had a snow week because the snow started coming down on Martin Luther King Jr. Day. And of course, they weren't in school that day. And then the next day, school was canceled. And then the next day, school was canceled. And then the next day, school had a 2-hour delay. And then the next day, school was canceled. So my kids had plenty of time. And they've really enjoyed the snow, and it's really melting today. We're supposed to have a high of 55 today. But yeah, some quick general updates, and I'm looking at my notes on screen when I glance away, or I'm just thinking to myself. But Forerunner, as you hear this, I'm recording
this addendum right now on January 24th, but when you hear this or watch this, it's January 25th, and there is one more week left on the Kickstarter campaign for Forerunner. The book will release on February 28th. And I have to, again, thank all the Kickstarter backers. As of right now, the campaign is 209% funded. So that's, yes, amazing. Now, if you're not on the campaign, there are some exclusive benefits for backing the campaign. For one, the Kickstarter backers will have special thanks in the front matter of the book. Not just the version that goes out to the Kickstarters, which will possibly have some special content as well. I'm working on that. But I'm going to send out a song recording or two to them. And there are some bookmarks as well as that won't be going out with the book if you go in and buy the book on launch day. Now with cover art, I got an update from the cover artist the night before last, and I still need to get back to her, but she's given me a beautiful design. If I decided that I accept it, then the art could be done now. I am going to suggest one or two small changes, I think. And I've been deliberating over that, which is why it's been a day and a half and I haven't gotten back to her yet. But I'll get back to her really fast so that she can give that to me and I can share it with you guys soon. Hopefully by next week. Beta readers. I've gotten some feedback already from beta readers. I think I might have mentioned that already. I don't remember. But some are still reading and, you know, I'm going to take the stragglers through the end of this week and then I'll kind of look at everything and see like what did they all kind of agree on that is great or needs to be remedied and you know, just make the book the best it can be. And I'll be putting out an ARC reader call soon. ARC is Advanced Reader Copy. You know, because you go on and look for a book on Amazon and it's kind of a lot of people don't want to buy something that doesn't already have several reviews. And I understand because I'm like that too. So a lot of authors will give away a free copy of their book to several readers who can then read it before the official launch day. And then as soon as the book launches, then if they like, they can leave a review. It's not obligatory because Amazon actually prohibits that. You can't give anything in exchange for reviews, but you can give something away free. Anyway, yeah, so I'm going to be putting out an ARC reader call soon so that I can have those reviews up on launch day. And if you would like to be in that group, send me an email. Send it to author@thorn.link and I'll put you in that pool. Now, if you are not sure, but you don't want that, but you do want to keep up to date, you can always join the newsletter. And that's at, this is a little bit long, thorn.link/grendhill/newsletter. And, or just send an email to newsletter@thorn.link. Well, I don't know, because you have to like officially accept, yes, I want emails. So if you send me an email to newsletter@thorn.link, I'll reply back with the link so that you can sign up for the newsletter. Or you can just go straight there, whatever. But yeah, you'll be able to keep up to date. You'll always know what's coming out from me, or from Grand Hill Media if we ever one day expand. But also, my newsletter subscribers receive exclusive short stories, and I'm sending out a short story with each newsletter. Now, the last one was, it's publicly available, I just don't really talk about it, that short story. But yeah, I'm writing another one this week, and that's going to go out to my short story, my newsletter subscribers, pardon me. So there's that too. And just so you know, for upcoming podcast episodes, next week we have an episode on plotting versus pantsing. with epic fantasy author Todd Fonestock. And he, by the way, he has a book coming out on February 7th. So it'll be nifty. You get to kind of know him through that podcast. And yeah, the following week, we have a discussion with Christine Erickson about how to launch a book. Now, Christine Erickson is married to Devin Erickson, and he recently launched his book, Theft of Fire, and it seems to be doing really well. And, you know, part of that is her work on getting the word out there, you know? So I'm actually going to take an idea from, I'm going to take a page out of their book. Haha. But, yeah, excuse me. She said that they did a video call with all of his beta readers after they had a chance to read his book. And I thought that was a fantastic idea. I had actually already received full feedback from one beta reader, and I shot him an email like, hey, can we do a call? And he was pretty busy, but he found the time to call me on the phone. And I loved that. It made sure that I knew what he was talking about in the points that he made. Cause he made some pretty good points, and I want to incorporate anything that's going to make the book better. For February 15th, I'm holding that reserved. We might have a special episode that week. Not a regular interview, but that one's not recorded yet. And then on February 22nd, is that a Thursday? Whatever that Thursday is, February 22nd, tomorrow I'm having an interview with a librarian, a public librarian, and getting his perspective on what he sees kids check out. And that will be very informative and very interesting, I expect. And then the following week will be the week that I launch my first book. And so we'll have a special episode centered around that. But yeah, this was supposed to be really short and quick, and I've been talking fast, but it's already been 8 minutes. So I'll cut you loose. See you next time on the Grand Hill Chronicles podcast.